There was a steel-toe cap on Wicklow's boot. Ryan chopped down just behind it. Lapanga cleaved through the first 3 inches of boot, all the way through the sole, and made a gash in the floor. The toe cap and its contents bounced away. For a second, there was no blood, and Ryan could see the white circle of 5 toe stumps in the now open-ended boot. Then the blood gushed. And gushed. His face dead white under all the whiskers and hair, Wicklow hopped on his good foot, trying in vain to staunch the bleeding with his free hand and keep Ryan off with the scythe. The torn hem of his robe tripped him up, and he fell hard onto his back. Ryan was on top of him a second after his head hit the floor. Straddling the man's chest, the one-eyed man brought the panga down hard with both hands. Not the point, but the knurled steel pommel. Amazingly, Wicklow didn't pass out. He spat shattered teeth and blood from his battered mouth and tried to get up. Before the bigger man could buck him off, Ryan flipped the blade around. With his left hand, he pressed the point over Wicklow's heart. His right hand, clenched in a fist, he held ready to pound it into the hilt. Realizing that all his wives were about to become widows, Wicklow stopped fighting. His body went limp, and he slumped back to the floor, blowing bubbles of blood. Ryan stood up and stepped away.
Finish the job, you sissy!
It was finished, as far as Ryan was concerned. There was no point in chilling the man. He was no longer a threat. Wicklow's wives rushed onto the stage to tend to their man's wounds. Two of them got the boot off, while the others made a tourniquet from a strip of the hem of his robe. They bound it around his instep and torqued it down hard with the scythe handle to stop the bleeding. There wasn't much they could do for his face. Pilgrim Plavik remounted the stage and held up his arms for silence.
Shut up!
Ryan looked down at Christy, then at Mildred and JB. They had their grins ready. Truth time.
No one in this room could claim the fight wasn't fair and square. Everything was done by the book. Praise Bob! Praise Enid!
Plavik glanced back at the loser, who was sitting up on the floor with the help of his womenfolk. There were bits of teeth in his beard, and the tips of the hair dripped blood.
You thrashed him good, Ryan. As far as I can see, he didn't even give you a scratch. Pilgrim Wicklow shamed everyone in this ville with a piss-poor fight he put up. Because you won, you keep your women. And you keep his trade goods, too.
Ryan frowned. That was part of the deal he hadn't foreseen.
Come on up here, Jubilee.
The pregnant girl walked across the stage. The sun was sinking below the horizon by the time the villefolk started filing out of the El Mirador. In all, 11 young women and girls had changed husbands, divorces and marriages accomplished in the same ceremony. 5 of the 6 pilgrims appeared satisfied with their respective deals, but to Ryan it seemed an odd satisfaction under the circumstances. Detached, passionless, as if they traded prize cows or pigs. The only celebration he'd witnessed was communal, a tribe thing. Although the pilgrims' wives welcomed the new brides with an embrace, the newlyweds themselves didn't touch, which was just fine with Ryan. His pregnant teenage bride followed on his heels as the companion set off across the town square park. Ryan shifted the stire on its shoulder sling to adjust the balance point. Christy, Mildred, Doc, Jack, and JB still had their blasters too. That the ville folk hadn't asked them to surrender their weapons surprised Ryan. Most remote villages in Deathlands had some kind of a leave-your-guns-at-the-gate policy to minimize the chance of violence. Not that the companions would have honored a request like that anyway. They were a different breed than the unarmed, sackcloth-robed farmers. They moved in sync, triple alert, like a military unit or chilling crew, their skins and clothing tinged with ground-in greasy dirt from the desert crossing. Creatures from the dark side.
You have to talk to her, Ryan. She didn't ask for this any more than you did.
Though Ryan also felt sorry for Jubilee, from experience he knew there were things he was powerless to change, and therefore had to accept. Like it or not, the hellscape was triple hard on its womenfolk, and the females who couldn't defend themselves, the young'uns, the dimmies, the physical weaklings, got the worst of it by far.
I know what you're thinking, Ryan. This is her place. These are her people. You want to leave her here when we go.
And you want to take her with us?
Well, they've already turned her into a baby-making machine. You heard that bug-eyed bastard Plavik bragging about how she was going to pop out 15 kids one after another until she drops dead? What kind of life is that for a human being?
I think you're jumping to conclusions. You're mixing up what you feel and what she feels. Maybe she wants to stay in Little Pueblo. It's all the life she knows.
That doesn't make it right.
Staying here is her best chance to survive, and you know it. If we have to walk across that desert and she comes along, she's never going to make it. It'd be kinder to put a bullet in her head right now.
What he didn't have to say was that the weight of one more life, two, counting the baby she carried on a desert crossing, might be enough to tip the balance and get them all chilled.
But we may not have to cross on foot. Not if we can break into the redoubt and access the Mat-Trans unit.
And the Mat-Trans still works.
Yeah, that too, of course.
Look, Christy, I don't want to get this girl's hopes up and then have to let her down. She's been hurt plenty. And she doesn't need more of that from us. If the Mat-Trans unit is operational and she wants to leave, we'll take her along. And at the other end, find a safe place for her to have her baby. If we can't get into the redoubt or the unit doesn't work, she stays behind. No arguments.
That seemed to satisfy Christy, at least for the moment. Ryan glanced over his shoulder. His new bride had dropped back a few yards, and Mildred was walking at her side, speaking softly to her. The pregnant girl wore her blonde hair pulled straight back and braided into a long, slender plait. She kept her blue eyes downcast and her pale lips drawn tight. Jubilee hadn't said two words to anybody since she crossed the El Mirador stage. If she'd even looked at Ryan, he hadn't seen it. He could understand how someone so young and in such dire straits would be numbed by the turn of events, expelled not only from her family group, but as things turned out, from her entire community, her lot suddenly thrown in with that of strangers. But there was something else, too. Under the shock, the feeling of being abandoned, under the sadness, there was fear. It was etched in her face in the way she carried herself. A more terrible fear than circumstances warranted, Ryan thought. Like she was walking a tightrope, or a plank, with doom all around her. Maybe she was crazy, or a drama queen. One thing was sure, she was 100 pounds of trouble. With his 4 wives and 10 children in tow, Pilgrim Plavik led the way across the park. He'd promised the companions a fine home-cooked meal to welcome them to Little Pueblo. Though his stomach was growling again, Ryan wasn't thinking about food. He was thinking about the black-heart, water-stealing son of a bitch they'd followed to the edge of the ville. If a man wandered into a place like this with no women to trade, nothing but his muscle and bone to offer, he was bound to end up in the theater's back rows and aisles with the other unhappy bachelors. No way would he make the rank of pilgrim overnight. In fact, the odds of him ever making pilgrim were slim. On its face, the social order of Little Pueblo appeared to be just that bottom-heavy. Without blasters or squads of sec men, the few had found a way to dominate the many. Jubilee wasn't the only one who kept her eyes focused on the ground most of the time. The single men and all the other women and children lowered their heads in deference to the ville's chosen ones. The 6 pilgrims controlled all the available females, and had therefore presumably sired all the ville's children. The non-alpha males hung around the fringes of the alpha males' harems, most likely doing all the field work, looking for their big chance to move up, or sneak some illicit fun when the pilgrims turned their backs. Not an unusual strategy for group survival. Ryan had seen it before, in other remote villes. What was unusual, however, there didn't appear to be any person, male or female, older than 30 years of age. When they reached the far side of the town square, Plavik took them across the street to the 3-story stone building with a tall clock tower. The clock wasn't working. At some point during the initial flooding or subsequent reemergence, one of its huge steel hands had fallen off. Every window facing the street was either crudely boarded up or covered with sheet plastic. As Plavik and his entourage trooped up a single flight of wide stone steps to the double front doors, Ryan noted the building's cornerstone, which bore the inscription, Little Pueblo City Hall, built 1913 A.D. Before he started up the steps, Ryan took a look back at the park. The other pilgrims and their families were crossing the street, heading for City Hall. Not Wicklow, though. He wasn't anywhere in sight. With half a right foot, it was going to be a while before he crossed anything. Although the whole town had followed them through the square, the non-pilgrim men had stopped short of the street and stood watching from the far side, a mob of robed ghosts. Inside, the pre-dark building showed considerable water damage. Most of the floor tiles were loose. The wooden trim moldings along the base of the walls, under the high ceiling, and around the doors were either missing or had warped and sprung loose from their moorings. The tan, glossy enameled walls showed broad patches of discoloration, as did the ceiling.
Centuries worth of mold from the smell of it.
Short of tearing out the load-bearing walls, there had been no way to dry out the laths and plaster after the reservoir had drained off. Plavik moved past a set of corroded elevator doors that had been nailed shut and decorated with the words, "All glory to Bob and Enid." He started up the staircase at the end of the entry hall. The stairs were made of steel and hadn't fared so well under 500 feet of water. The treads and railings had completely rusted out in spots. In others, the metal was filigreed and paper thin. The major damage had been repaired and braced with scraps of wood, iron pipe, angle brackets, and baling wire. As Plavik and his family climbed, and the companions followed, the whole staircase began to groan and shake. Only Ryan and the companion seemed concerned by this. Six flights up, they moved off the rickety stairs and onto the building's top floor. The town's municipal offices, pre-flood, had been turned into living quarters. The rooms were furnished in the same junkyard style as the one-story businesses around the square. Crude beds on concrete blocks, crude mattresses made of straw, the occasional piece of watermarked veneer-peeling furniture, no rugs on the floors, mold spots on the walls, between hand-lettered imprecations to Bob and Enid. One room had been turned into a kitchen. The stove, a pre-dark Kenmore Electric, had been stripped, raised a foot and a half from the floor by stacked steel wag rims, and converted to burn wood. Its makeshift vent pipe poked out through a hole in the scrap metal that covered the tall, narrow window. The brief home tour ended where it had begun, in one of the suite's living room bedrooms. Plavik offered his guests seats on the various platform beds, then dismissed his women and children with an impatient wave of his hand. The children made themselves scarce, and the wives moved into the kitchen to prepare the feast. When Jubilee started to follow the women, Mildred caught her by the arm and made her sit down. Plavik seemed amused by this. Though Ryan and the others sat, they couldn't pretend to look comfortable. It wasn't just the hard beds, or the smell of mold, or the subjugation of the Ville's women. Plavik's body language and facial expression told them he had something up his sleeve, something nasty. Big fun for him, the opposite of big fun for everyone else.
Why don't you tell us something about your Ville?
The bug-eyed man twisted a strand of beard around his index finger.
Little Pueblo was, then it wasn't, then it was again. When I showed up here, it had been risen from the ashes for nearly a century. Praise Bob, praise Enid. I came over from the east, at the border of the Shens. That's where all my people lived. Wanted to see some of the world while I was young. Set off on my own. I was wild and triple stoop back then. Worked in Gaudy's and Jolt shacks all through the Western Territories. I ran my own string of skanky sluts on the side. Sold battery acid disguised as Jolt to folks dumber than me and did some robbing when it didn't take too much effort. To make a long story short, I got myself in one big stinking mess after another. And the scrapes always ended up with blades or blasters and blood on the floor. I'll tell you, I'm lucky to be walking around alive today.
So you just wandered in from the desert like us?
Started out at the very bottom of the shit pile. Came here with nothing and half dead from the sun. But I got better before they could bury me, and I learned the ways of the Ville. There's no place to run once you get here. You know how close the desert came to taking you out. Before you'd go through that again, you'll make do with almost anything, so long as there's some shade, some water, and something to eat. Because I had some size on me, and I like to mix it up, I worked myself from field slave to overseer in less than a year. The men who objected to my taking their jobs got themselves drowned in the lake and turned into fertilizer. I'd been an overseer for maybe 6 months when I chilled Pilgrim Boone and took everything he owned. Boone, he was a real big son of a bitch, even for a pilgrim. 300 pounds stripped naked, and all of it mean. One night I caught him on the staircase in this building, four flights up. Surprised him from the shadows with a stout rope. Had the noose around his neck and cinched tight before he knew what was happening. Then I practically ruptured myself, pitching his fat ass over the stair rail. The bitter end was tied off real good, but Boone was so heavy, his falling weight broke the rope in the middle.